Well, thank you for coming today. We're going to have our last class of the summer series this week. The next couple weeks, we're going to have some special topics classes. So today, we're actually going to finish our survey of the early church and also the ancient world in which the early church began. The topics today will kind of tie together in a way, because what we want to do is to tie together some loose ends as in terms of some of the changes that we've studied happening to the early church, kind of tie that together and find out where the early church was at the start of the Middle Ages, and then also we'll kind of follow our friends from Rome and see what happened to them, see what finally happened to this empire that we've been talking about for so long, too. It's kind of a historical curiosity, or maybe more than a curiosity. It has significance in some ways that the say at the same time that the early church was completing its total transformation from the informal organization that you see in the scriptures to a highly rigid institution that you see in the Middle Ages. And at the same time, the world itself changed significantly because of the fall of the Western Empire and the way that that affected enormous parts of the world in so many different ways. So we're going to finish up that story today. And then the next couple of weeks, we're going to have some special topics Frank and Jim are arranging for us. And then on September 9th, I'll be back with the autumn class, which we will pick up where we left off with this class. For anyone who's interested, we're going to pick up at the beginning of the Middle Ages with the fact that the church has become something very different than what we see in the scriptures, and we'll go through the subsequent history and look at the things that people have done and thought and tried with the idea of trying to return in some sense, in some way, to the church that we see in the New Testament. And of course, that will, if I stay on schedule over the course of the fall, it will end with the fellowship that we're part of. John is going to lead us in a time of prayer to get ready, and then we'll get into our study. Amen. Very good. Just some scriptures. First of all, if we go over in 2 Timothy 2, read a couple of scriptures just to give us some perspective on the era in which we're going to study. We're going to take a look at the years in which the church that we've been looking at in the New Testament kind of completed a complete transformation into something very different. We're also going to look at the years in which the world was drastically transformed by the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, which had been such a part of everyone's lives for so long, Christian and non-Christian alike. And so a couple of these scriptures will give us some thoughts in terms of being able to step back a little bit. It's the tendency when we look at history, whether it's secular history or religious history, to want to find people who are responsible for the problems, to want to assign blame, to want to assign guilt, and that's really not the best way to deal with things. So instead, we're kind of going to look at some things, maybe give us a little bit of spiritual perspective and step back a little bit. 2 Timothy 2, Jenny, you've had time to peruse the trivia question now and get your Bible open. So could you read 2 Timothy? You've already probably already got the answer to the question, I'm sure.
No, I don't. I don't have my
device. Oh, okay. Well, you wouldn't cheat anyway, would you?
No, I wouldn't.
No, you always have a nice, clean paper Bible there. So that's why we're going to have you get us started. 2 Timothy 2. This is actually a passage. We won't read the whole passage. We're just going to start here in verse 19. But this is a passage you might be familiar with, because he's encouraging Timothy to present himself to God as a workman who correctly handles the word of truth. And he's detailed some of the problems that even at that time were going on with people teaching different things about Jesus, people teaching some rather bizarre things. And he gives Timothy not so much an instruction as to go around and stamp out all the false teachings, but he gives Timothy some solid perspective on how to manage this in his own mind. 19 to 21. Okay, very good. Thank you very much. In other words, Paul is explaining to Timothy, yes, indeed, there's all kind of people out there teaching all kind of crazy things. You know, I hope you've learned by now that that's not a new problem. That's almost as soon as this church began, people started teaching all kind of different things. But what does Paul tell Timothy about this situation? Does Paul give Timothy a checklist to determine who's saved and who's not? Instead, what does he say? He gives him a totally different kind of assurance. In verse 19, he says, God has a solid foundation. And what's the inscription on that solid foundation? Yeah. God knows who are his. In other words, Timothy's not always going to be able to tell. Now, presumably, Timothy knows himself that he has a relationship with God, that his sins have been forgiven. You and I can know that about ourselves. That's a different lesson. So if you don't, then talk to somebody, because that's an important thing in itself. But what Paul is doing is different. Timothy can know that his sins have been forgiven, but what he's saying is it's really only God that ever knows for sure about anybody else, because there's no such thing as doing enough to be saved. So you can't really ever look at someone, oh, that person does enough, I know he's saved. You can't ever tell that. Conversely, there's no such thing as doing too many bad things that you can't be saved. So you can never look at someone else and say, look at all the bad stuff that person's doing, they're not saved. You can never say that either, because salvation is by grace. And this other little scripture, I put a note on the board, 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9, when Paul was struggling with some troubles in his life, remember what God said to him? My grace is sufficient for you. That's all you need, is my grace. God's grace is sufficient. We don't need to know exactly where everybody else stands. We just need to treat everybody else as our brothers and sisters, and treat everybody else with compassion and grace and love. And God knows those who are his. And that's a solid foundation. Not here's exactly how you can tell who's saved and who's not. That wouldn't be a solid foundation. It might give us a sense of false security, but it wouldn't be a truly solid foundation. And what Paul then goes on to tell Timothy is kind of interesting. He uses this example of a house. He says, in a large house, you got all kind of different stuff. Everybody in their home, they might have a few really special things made out of gold or silver, or in our cases, we probably don't have too much gold and silver, but you probably got some special objects lying around in your house, a prolate spheroid signed by one of the Buckeyes or something like that. And you've also got a lot of junk. You've also got a lot of stuff that either isn't very useful or that may be useful, but it's not especially valuable. And it's an interesting example, because what he's saying is, he's calling Timothy not to make judgments, but to do what? In verse 21. Doesn't say Timothy go around judging and evaluate everyone else, but do what? Cleanse yourself from things that for ignoble purposes. And cleanse, for those of you who are fans of Leviticus, the partner of cleansing is holiness. He says, make yourself useful to the master. In other words, make yourself holy. Give yourself to God. And what he's telling Timothy is that the solid foundation is not that we can know everything that we want to know, but that we can know that we've received the grace, and we can know that other people need grace, whether they've received it yet or not. And so the historical reason why that's important is because there's such a strong tendency to look back at history and try to decide who was doing it right, who was doing it wrong, instead of just learning a much more basic lesson from history. Whether you're studying the church, or whether you're studying the Romans, whether you're studying our own country's history, there's a very powerful lesson that every page of history and every year of history teaches, which is that we all need a lot of grace because we all make a lot of mistakes. Every individual makes a lot of mistakes. Every church makes a lot of mistakes. Every country makes a lot of mistakes. Everyone does embarrassing things. Everyone does ugly things. Everyone thinks foolish things. It's a universal aspect of human nature. And so the study of history, if we're getting out of it who was right and who was wrong, and who was a snake and who was a good guy, then we've missed the lesson that God wants to teach us. The lesson of history is that we all really need a lot of grace, a lot of forgiveness, a lot of mercy, a lot of help that we don't deserve. And that's true whether you study secular history or church history. And this is kind of what Paul is encouraging Timothy. He says, God knows those who are his. You cleanse yourself from stuff you know is bad. Give yourself to God. Let God cleanse you and make you holy. Over in Romans chapter 11, a little bit more pointed lesson that Paul teaches us. The context of this passage is Paul's discussion of the ancient nation of Israel. He's talking about the fact, which to Paul was extremely discouraging. Paul loved his own nation. You know, Paul had spent his whole life before being a Christian being what he called a Jew of Jews, an Israelite of Israelites. And after becoming a Christian, it tormented Paul to know that the vast majority of the people of Israel did not accept Jesus, and apparently were never going to accept Jesus. And so it's in this context that Paul is talking about, well, what does this mean? That the vast majority of Israelites rejected the Messiah that was sent to them. And so Paul is wrestling this with himself, as well as teaching other Christians to put this in a little bit better perspective. Jennifer, have you got that for us? Could you read verses 1 to 6 of Romans 11?
I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means, for I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people. Do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah, how he appeals to God against Israel? Lord, they have killed your prophets, they have demolished your altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. But what is God's reply to him? For I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed to the knee to Baal. So too, at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. But if it is by grace, it is no longer the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. What then? Is through 7?
That's good enough. That's good enough. Yeah, you've done a great job. There's no such thing as too much scripture, right? That's fine. I know you hang out with Norma, so that's okay. And there would be actually more. And actually, I'll make sure to work that in, just to make you look good. What Paul is telling us is something combines a couple of important points. He gives us example about Elijah, and this is back in 1 Kings 19, if you want to read the full context. Elijah is being chased around by King Ahab and Queen Jezebel. They were trying to kill him. He was all by himself, and he was running away, and he hid up on a mountain, and he was all despairing. And Paul quotes what you can read this back in Kings. Elijah says to God, God, they've killed all the prophets, they've torn down all your altars, I'm the only one left, pretty soon they're going to kill me, and after they kill me, what's going to happen? There's going to be no one who believes in you. And what is God's answer? God's answer is, no, not so. Exactly, not so. He said, no, there's still 7,000 Israelites who aren't worshiping Baal, they're still faithful, they're still out there. And if you go back to 1 Kings 19, eventually after comforting Elijah, God tells him to go back to Israel because those 7,000 other people, they need the encouragement that you can offer them just as you need the encouragement that they can offer you. And in fact, God had already directed him to Elisha, who is going to be a great support and companion to him. What Paul is saying is that there's always a remnant. There's never any such thing as a world without people who seek God. We tend to sometimes look and become fixated with the despairing side, with the side of we look at the externals, they're doing this, and these people are doing that, and this church is doing that, and the government's doing this, and there's just nobody around. There's nobody who seeks God anymore. And what God is telling Elijah is the same thing he's telling us. No, the idea of seeking God is a powerful one. Humans were made in God's image. We were made to seek God. There's always people who are seeking God. Maybe they're not doing it very effectively. Maybe they're not finding a lot of companionship in doing it, but there's always people seeking God. We should never doubt that. There's always people who want to know God. There's always a remnant. Now, a remnant is a concept that you can read about a great deal in the Old Testament, most especially in the book of Isaiah, right? That's one of Isaiah's favorite topics. This is where Paul's getting a lot of his material, by the way. So Paul knew his Isaiah. And what he's saying is that God's never without a remnant. God's never without people who are following him. It's always there. And this is true when we study, if you're in the fall class, when we study through the Middle Ages, or as they're often called, the Dark Ages, when you study through all the era when there wasn't the New Testament church, and they still hadn't yet opened the doors and hung up a sign that said the USA Church of Christ, that doesn't mean that there weren't a lot of people who knew God. It doesn't mean that there weren't a lot of people who were seeking God, who wanted to know God for his own sake. There's always been groups to do that. Maybe they didn't look like ours. Maybe they didn't do things the way that we did. But what Paul is saying is that's not the real issue. It's were they seeking God for his own sake, and were they seeking him by grace? Because the other part of that phrase that's important, one is, yes, there's always a remnant. But what's the rest of that phrase? The remnant is chosen by correct belief. Right? There's always a remnant chosen by correct belief.
Grace.
No. There's always a remnant chosen by numerical growth. No. There's always a remnant chosen by moral superiority. No. The remnant is chosen by grace. See, that's kind of the kicker. You know, it's one thing to say there's always a remnant. That's right. Yeah. We're the remnant. Yeah. Whoop, over here, we're the remnant. We're the ones still doing it right. That's missing the point too. It's one thing to say, oh, there's nobody around. That's wrong. But then the other extreme is, oh, yeah, that's right. There's a remnant, and it's us, and we need to get out there and teach everyone else, straighten everybody up. No, that's the other mistake, because the remnant is chosen by grace. The remnant is not the people who are doing it right. They're not the people teaching it right. They're the people who can look at their own hearts and say, I need a lot of grace. Jesus, would you please give me all the grace that I need? The remnant is chosen by grace, and it's saved by grace. And it's an interesting statement the way Paul concludes this, because he knows you characters just as well as I do, because he clarifies it in verse 6. He says, if it's by grace, then it's not by works. Because if it were by works, then it wouldn't be by grace. In other words, he's saying if the remnant is chosen by their works, whether it's by correct belief or by moral superiority or by numerical growth, then it's no longer by grace, is it? If that's the criteria you're going to use to identify the remnant, then it isn't by grace. It's got to be grace, and by grace alone is what he's saying. And this is something that is difficult perhaps for the human mind to accept fully, the idea that the remnant just can't be identified by the things that we use to identify right and wrong in every other context. We're used to identifying right and wrong, correct and incorrectness, by either by force of numbers, you know, by who wins the war, by who wins the election, by who wins the football game, that must justify those people's choices and the things they're doing. And it just doesn't work that way. God says the real remnant that matters to him is chosen by grace. And it's chosen by those who can humbly accept God's grace. And there are a lot of people throughout history, back in the Middle Ages when there was no group called the Church of Christ, there were a lot of people who humbly asked Jesus for grace. And they had a relationship with God, even though what they did probably didn't look a lot like what we do. Even though they may have thought a lot of other things that were maybe very much at odds with what we believe. There's also people today who seek Jesus by grace. Maybe what they're doing doesn't look like what we're doing. But if they're seeking Jesus by grace, truly by grace and not by works, then they're part of the remnant, whether they look like us or not. This is what he's saying. And if you go back, actually no, if we'll there's this extra verse that Jennifer had deeper perception into this passage than I do, because look what he says in verse 7, as Jennifer so wisely read for us. What then? What Israel sought so earnestly, what happened? It did not obtain. Israel tried so hard to do it right. But that doesn't work, does it? And now, I had a different passage in mind going back, which we'll work mine in anyway, even though Jennifer's was better. If you look back at chapter 9, verse 30, he says something similar. What then shall we say? The Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness, what happened? They obtained it, a righteousness that's by faith. But Israel, who pursued a law of righteousness, did not. Why not? Because they pursued it not by faith, but as if it were by works. They stumbled over the stumbling stone. They stumbling over the stumbling stone of grace. The stumbling stone that says you can't make a law perfect enough. You can't make a theological system perfect enough. You can't come up with an evangelistical method that's perfect enough to save you. That doesn't make you part of the remnant. You've got to accept it by faith in God's grace. You have to have the faith that it's by grace alone that you're saved, and you have to have the humility to accept the blood of Jesus as your only way to God. And that's what makes the remnant. And coming back to history, if it's by grace, then it just isn't by works. And so our way of looking at all the groups throughout history, we want to try as best as we can, being fallible human beings, to look at them through the eyes of grace. They made an awful lot of mistakes, but everybody does. We do too. We've got blind spots. They had blind spots. And to see that the remnant is chosen by grace. Now, switching a little bit, historical topics. One of the topics that we wanted to finish, because we keep kind of following the history of Rome as we follow the history of the church, but the history of Rome is kind of inextricably intertwined with it. And there's a little bit of extra meaning to it, because the story of the declining years of Rome, it doesn't have anything to do with the Bible, but there are spiritual lessons to it. And the spiritual lesson to the fall of Rome is not, see, that's why people need to vote for my party instead of the other one. The spiritual lesson of the fall of Rome is all human achievement and power and position is inherently fragile. The Romans had this incredible power for hundreds of years, but it eventually dissipated. And from a spiritual point of view, our lives in this world should not be about clinging to and desperately trying to hang on to material things or political power or superiority over other cultures or nations so much as, again, learning the humility that enables us to live by grace. The Roman Empire reached its peak, just to give you a little historical survey. Emperor Trajan, who is noted in church history because he's the one that investigated Christians and decided that basically Christianity was going to be illegal, but it wasn't going to be enforced except for people who really caused trouble. Trajan was also kind of the peak of the Roman Empire. Trajan was emperor from 98 to 117. He was a very effective leader, very forceful leader, and Rome really enjoyed its best days under Trajan. From Trajan all the way down to Diocletian, who was unfortunately a great persecutor of Christians, this was a long period of decline. Long period of decline from Trajan. You have after him, there was a couple emperors who weren't bad, but they really didn't do anything to strengthen Rome. You had Hadrian and Antoninus, and then Marcus Aurelius. They kind of consolidated what Trajan had done. After Marcus Aurelius died, his successor, for some reason when I was a pagan, I thought this was hilarious. His successor was named Commodus, which is very appropriate because Rome started going down the commode during his reign. He was a former gladiator, and he was very popular because he'd won a lot of gladiatorial combats, and the people thought, he's such a great guy, and we're such a powerful country, why don't we just make him emperor? And of course, something like that would never happen in our democracy, where decisions are made by such well-informed and wise citizens. But that's what happened. And Rome started this long decline. And Diocletian, who unfortunately was a persecutor of Christians, but he was a very effective administrator from a secular viewpoint, he instituted a lot of reforms. There were two basic problems in Rome. You had internal decay and rivalry, which became very fierce at times. You saw it especially when an emperor would die. A lot of times there would be very bloody combat to decide who would be the next emperor. And you also had a lot of just internal decay. Rome was very materialistic, they were very hedonistic, and that weakened them a great deal more than they ever realized. You also had pressure from outside the borders from what is always referred to as the barbarian tribes. Lots of the people along Rome's borders looked in at the Roman Empire. Rome, of course, maintained its borders very, very vigorously for many years, and there were a lot of people on the outside who wanted in. They wanted territory. They wanted to share some of the things the Romans had. And Diocletian pretty much took care of the internal problems. He had a lot of reforms that really strengthened the empire from within. He pretty much just kind of held off the pressure from the barbarian tribes. But his successors, which not long after Diocletian, they were the Christian emperors. Constantine became emperor in 312, and from then on all the emperors but one were Christians. They basically did a very poor job of making use of what Diocletian had done. They inherited a stronger empire. They pretty much squandered it because they were too busy, in a lot of cases, arguing about whether the so-called Trinity was three persons of one substance or one person with three substances. They kind of felt that was a little bit more important, and so they ignored all these problems. They basically had a strategy. All these barbarian tribes, and they're all known to history if you know the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths and the Huns and all kind of other people, the Vandals, all kinds of them that you can read about in history. When I was a kid, for some reason I liked the name Visigoths. When someone was acting like a bully or something like that, I used to call them a Visigoth because they didn't know what it meant. I used to say, "You're a real Visigoth, aren't you?" And they would never know what it meant, and they'd stop hassling me long enough to try and figure out what I had just said, and I could slip away and escape. But these guys, in a lot of cases, they were being pressured too. A lot of the barbarian tribes that eventually attacked Rome, it's because they were being attacked by other barbarian tribes. And Rome, for so long, just maintained this rigid border that they were indirectly causing a lot of troubles for a lot of other people with a lot of difficult situations. Well, the Christian emperors kind of came up with a temporary solution that they thought was going to be very effective, but it turned out to be disastrous. They would let very small groups of these people within Rome's borders, and they would promise them territory in return for extra military service. And they would promise them all kind of things. Okay, you give us 1,000 of your best men to serve in our army for X many years, and then when they're done, we'll give you some nice territory, and we'll give you this other stuff too, and we'll give you all kind of things. The problem is that they kept promising all these things and trying to exploit these people because they were ferocious fighters, putting them in the Roman army. Well, eventually these people, they just because they're, quote, barbarians doesn't mean they're stupid. And eventually they started to figure out that they were just being used. And it kind of exploded, and it's kind of famous in secular history. In AD 378 at Adrianople, there were some Goths that had become extremely outraged by this policy. And the Goths that were in the Roman army kind of realized that they were kind of being pawns used in this little game that the emperors were playing, and they revolted. And it was an absolute disaster for the Romans. They're the Goths within the imperial territory, and their other Goths from outside the empire kind of combined together to surprise the Romans and slaughtered off thousands of Roman soldiers without any trouble whatsoever. And it was kind of an alarm signal to the Romans, but it was also kind of like saying to all these other barbarian tribes, Rome ain't what it used to be. They're not as strong as they used to be. And all these barbarian tribes kind of figured out at the same time, hey, we don't have to be patronized and taken advantage of and lied to. We just grab the territory ourselves if that's what we want. And so it started this climactic phase of Roman history that's filled with all kind of chaotic battles and all kind of chaotic alliances amongst these barbarian tribes and all kind of desperate things that the Romans tried to do to hold this off. Well, by the 5th century, by the AD 400, the Romans realized that things were going downhill very quickly. They were really in trouble. And so the Roman leaders, the emperor and his court, made a decisive decision to take care of this problem. In AD 404, they moved out of Rome and established a new capital in a little fortress called Ravenna along the Adriatic Sea coast, so that no matter what else happened, they'd be safe. That was the decision that the imperial leaders took to deal with this problem. So in AD 404, they moved the capital to Ravenna, which is not too far from actually where my wife's family is from. It's on the seacoast and along the Adriatic Sea there. My father-in-law grew up not too far from there. The reason they did that is because it was very inaccessible. It was easily fortified. And so for the rest of Rome's declining years, all the leaders could just hang out there whenever they wanted to. And whatever happened to everybody else, it wasn't going to affect them. Well, the first group that actually broke in on a large scale to the borders were the Visigoths, my favorites when I was a kid. They had a leader called Alaric, who came to power in AD 404, and he launched a full-scale invasion of Italy itself. Until then, these barbarian tribes had been snipping off pieces of the empire in distant areas. Alaric was the first one bold enough to invade right through the heart of Italy, because he realized that they weren't going to do anything. They were hiding in Ravenna, and they weren't going to do anything about it. And so he invaded Italy proper, and in AD 410 was the first sack of Rome. Alaric and the Visigoths reached Rome. They broke through the gates without a lot of trouble. They killed off a lot of people in the city, and they carted away a lot of the wealth and committed a lot of acts of random violence. And it was a sensation. It was a world-shaking event, really almost literally, except for parts of the world that were far distant. It was something that people thought would never, ever happen. And it's very interesting, because since by this time, for almost 100 years, the emperors of Rome had been Christians, it really shook a lot of people, their assumptions about the church, too. We've kind of tracked that by this time, the church had become something very different. The church by this time had been very closely allied with the imperial government, and this is in the period of the church when people had become expected to be very closely conformed to whatever you were told to do by your leaders, whatever they told you to say, whatever they told you to believe, whatever they told you to do, whatever little ritual. You were supposed to do that. And there was an understanding that everybody had that, okay, we're doing this stuff because the church is going to take care of us. You know, the government and God are closely allied here, and so we do the stuff they want, they take care of us. We do their little rituals, we're happy and prosperous and safe, right? And that was very overtly used by the church leaders for decades. But then when Rome itself fell, wow, that really called that into question. Hey, that doesn't work, does it? You can't just do these rituals and repeat these little statements and it keep you safe. It doesn't work, does it? Well, there was a big, what we would call today, a backlash. A lot of Christians started to think, hey, maybe this new business of the empire running the church, maybe it's not all it's cracked up to be. There were still a lot of unbelievers left. And they were starting to think, our old gods are finally having their revenge here. And it was a sensation. And if it was one of those things that if they'd had these ridiculous cable news networks, and I apologize for the redundancy, they would have obsessively had one expert after another pontificating about what it means for the spiritual content of our country, when, of course, we would never obsess over things like that ourselves, so we can make fun of them. But that's what they did. Well, it's actually, this is the setting of a famous book. If you've ever heard of Augustine of Hippo, wrote a famous book called The City of God. That was kind of like the establishment response to this. And it's actually a very profound book in some ways, even though Augustine was very closely allied with the empire, and it was kind of like a defense of what the church had done. It still contains some powerful concepts. The concept of the city of God comes from some of the scriptures, that we have a city with foundation that's not here in this world. And what Augustine said is, yes, there is a disaster. Augustine kind of partly allied himself with what the church was doing. He was very establishment in terms of the rituals and all that. But he also said, that doesn't mean that we get everything we want in this world. It doesn't mean that things go well in this world, because there's a more important city that we're going to with foundation. And it's a very interesting book to read in light of its original context. It's extremely long. So if you're tempted to read it, it's fine. It's worth reading. It's very long, very wordy, sometimes very superficial, because Augustine really kind of glossed over the sufferings that the Roman people went through because of their irresponsible leaders. But some of the things that he has to say are very profound. He kind of traces the history of believers up to his day, and a lot of things he said are worth reading. Well, this first sack of Rome was only the beginning. Of course, that encouraged the barbarian tribes even further. They continued to chip away at the empire, and by the middle of the 5th century, things were nearing a disaster. I'm sure, even if you haven't heard of all these other people, Alaric and the Visigoths and everyone, I'm sure you've heard of this guy, Attila. Attila the Hun. Attila the Hun took over the Huns, which used to be a minor tribe. Yeah, they barely made the top 25 until Attila took them over. But Attila was like getting a new big-time coach. He turned the Huns into a real fighting force. He took over about in 433, I think, and he transformed the Huns into the most feared of all of these tribes. And Attila started rampaging through Roman territory, and he kind of made Alaric and the Visigoths and all these guys, he kind of made them look like a goodwill tour, because Attila enjoyed killing and raping people and destroying things for its own sake. And Attila just struck terror into the hearts of the Romans. And he launched a campaign again. He invaded directly towards Rome, and he reached Rome, or near the outskirts of Rome, about 450. And again, the imperial leaders and the church took a very decisive response. They called the Council of Chalcedon to debate some false teachings that they saw in the church that needed to be dealt with urgently. And so all the church leaders and all the imperial leaders met in this resort area called Chalcedon, where they sat and had this luxurious resort, and they sat around and debated all these arcane spiritual points while Attila and the Huns approached Rome and got ready to destroy it. And it's an interesting thing, and it has a lot to do with subsequent church history. AD 452, Attila and his army reached the gates of Rome. The only person who'd come back from Chalcedon, the council was in 451, and most of the leaders of the empire stayed there when they heard that even after the council was over, they stayed. I guess they argued with each other a little bit more just for fun instead of officially. The only one who came back was this guy named Leo, who was the Bishop of Rome. And Leo was back in Rome. He was the only person there. And when Attila came to the gates, there was no army. They'd all run away. There was no government. There was nobody but the bishop. And Leo he really had, in a lot of ways, an ill effect on later church history, but he was a very brave person. Leo, all by himself, he saw the city was about to be utterly ravaged by these Huns. He walked all by himself out of the city gates up into the Hun camp, said, where's Attila? And walked right into Attila's tent, all by himself. And he gave him this big schmooze job, buttered Attila up, told him what an incredible leader he was to have overcome these armies. He said, you are the scourge of God. My people are undeserving of the blessings God has given them, and God has chosen you to teach them a lesson, and you have done it. You have served a valuable purpose, and now your purpose is done. We're going to give you all these gifts. We'll give you all these kind of things. Your job is done. You don't have to destroy the city itself. We've learned that you are more powerful than us. Well, unbeknownst to Leo, Attila was very sick, and his army was being ravaged by disease, and they were hungry because they so much enjoyed destroying everything that they didn't even properly nourish themselves, they didn't even have the sense when they destroyed a city to take some food along. At least you're going to kill everybody. Don't just destroy all the food. At least take something for yourself. So Attila was ready to call it quits because he was kind of desperate too. And so Attila, here's this guy from Attila's point of view, you're offering me all this stuff without even the need to have to fight for it. Sure, we'll take all your gifts and we'll go home. And it was an amazing thing because in the eyes of the people of the Rome, Leo had worked a miracle. And Leo, in fact, historically is the first true pope, because Leo was, because of this great thing that he did, for the rest of his life, people would do anything that he told them to do. People would believe anything that Leo told them to believe. And so he rescued the city from the Hun invasion. Well, it only held things off for a few years because this other tribe, the Vandals, which is where we get our word, the Vandal, because they were so destructive too. A few years later, AD 455, they came back, and they were so overpowering that no one could stop them. And so Rome ended up being sacked anyway. The Vandals probably did it in a little bit less destructive way than the Huns, because they, despite their name, they were a little bit less destructive than some of these other tribes. But they put an end to Roman power. They took it over for themselves in 455. The imperial court still continued to exist for about 20 years. The so-called emperors had this tiny little kingdom a few miles square in Ravenna, and they enjoyed themselves pretending that they were still emperors for about 20 years until 476 is when the empire officially ended. This German named Odoacer decided that it just irked him that these people thought they were emperors, so he went and wiped them out and took care of it, and that was the end of the Western Roman Empire. Kind of, as the saying goes, it ended with a whimper rather than with a bang. That's a story of the declining years of Rome. And it, as I said, it's kind of inextricably intertwined with the transformation of the church. And you can see some of the mileposts in the history of the church are pretty closely allied to where Rome was at this time. You know, before Constantine in AD 312, you know, before 312, the church was illegal. And so even though the church had a lot of problems, you can say, even though we can't really judge, but you can say with a high degree of certainty, those people were almost surely faithful to God. Because there wasn't any reason to be a Christian unless you really believed the gospel. It made no sense. You lost a lot of civil rights. You lost a lot of security. You were always in danger of being tossed in jail whenever the empire wanted. So before 312, even though we've documented some of the problems that they had, they were almost certainly faithful in at least a basic way. And they certainly relied on God's grace. Because they knew every morning when they woke up, it was by God's grace that they weren't in jail or being executed or something. Well, Constantine, of course, once imperial power was allied with the church, that changed a lot of things. And the first big step was at Nicaea in 325. Constantine's first few years, he concentrated on getting rid of all the laws against Christianity. He made the first day of the week a holiday so that for the first time it could be a day of rest as well as a day of worship. And he did some other things to try to make Christianity mainstream. But then pretty soon, he and the imperial authorities began to get involved in running the church. And so throughout the 4th century, you have the steady process by which the church was gradually made to conform. And the imperial government and the church leaders kind of formed a close alliance where they kind of merged their agendas and where they would, one issue at a time, begin to announce, here's what you believe about this now. Don't trouble yourselves anymore with the scriptures. We'll take care of it for you. Here's some rituals to follow. Here's what we're going to do. We'll take care of you if you just follow the things that we tell you to do. And this is the era in which a lot of that really came into being. And the next milepost is really what we were just talking about. In AD 400 to 410, this is when the doubts began to creep in. And two events. One is this first sack of Rome, which was calling into doubt a lot of the implicit promises that people believed in. Okay, we've been following all these rituals and everything and believing whatever the emperor tells us to believe, and he can't take care of us? Well, that's a problem, isn't it? You also had a very interesting, purely spiritual controversy called the Pelagians. Pelagius was a person who revolted against the church's orthodoxy. But he went to another extreme. One of the things that was implemented during the 4th century is the doctrine that's called original sin. One of the things the church taught people as a reason why you needed to listen to everything they told you is because you didn't just fall into sin at some point in your life. You were born sinful. You inherited the sin of your parents because they inherited the sin of their parents because they inherited the sin of their parents all the way back to Adam. Original sin is still taught in some religious groups. It's that you're sinful from the moment you're born. And you need to be saved by grace from the moment that you're born. And this was originally used in the 4th century as a justification to say, and that's why, boys and girls, you'll never be able to make decisions about spiritual matters for yourselves. You're always going to have to listen to us tell you what to believe and what to do because you were sinful from the moment that you were born. And you're never going to be able to figure it out. So let us tell you what to do, and we'll fix it for you. Well, Pelagius rebelled against this idea. Unfortunately, Pelagius, not that we would ever do this, he swung to a completely different extreme. Because what Pelagius did is he was kind of so appalled by this denial of our free will that he swung free will to a completely opposite extreme. Pelagius taught that not only is original sin baloney, but we don't even really need God's grace at all. We're perfectly capable of being moral on our own. We got Jesus as an example, and he's there to teach us how to live, and if we're just good enough, we don't need the church at all. We don't need even God at all, much less the church. It's just an equal and opposite extreme. And so you can see that's a different way of looking at the church of that time, how you're seeing people resist and rebel against this orthodoxy, but doing what? Lurching off into their own extreme, lurching off into their own problems. And then you come to the fall of Rome. Leo I is what he's known to history or called the Great. He is really a key figure. This is the guy who confronted Attila, and Leo really had some outstanding qualities. Leo was a very intelligent person and a very engaging person, very attractive personality, which is a rare combination. Leo also was absolutely untempted by anything material, couldn't offer him enough money or material things to tempt him. And he was willing to take great personal risks. I mean, a guy that could walk into the tent of Attila the Hun all by himself and start trying to schmooze him and butter him up, that's a guy that's got some courage right there. Leo's one weakness is that he loved power. He loved power for power's sake. He loved being the guy in charge. And he kind of parlayed his confrontation with Attila and the disastrous situation. Everybody knew that the imperial leaders were a bunch of wimps. And Leo just basically said, hey, you do things my way, I'll take care of everything else. And people at that time, if you just have to put yourself in the place of the people at that time, the terror, the uncertainty, the insecurity, knowing that all your other leaders were complete wimps, people said, yeah, Leo, you're the man. We will do. He asked for and received absolute power over the church. The entire European church said, Leo speaks for God. We're going to do it his way. In the East, it was a little bit different story. The East resisted that because they still didn't have the problems with the barbarian tribes in the East that they did in the West. The Asian churches didn't go along with that. North Africa, where there were a lot of churches, that was kind of a battleground. A lot of the churches in North Africa were worried that they would be next, their territories would be the next to be invaded, and they wanted Leo's protection. A lot of the churches in North Africa were very independent, and in fact, remained independent long after Rome fell. So that was kind of a spiritual battleground, so to speak. But Leo really completed that transformation from where the church was heading anyway. And I kind of think it probably was inevitable anyway. I don't really like to blame Leo because he had so many good qualities. And he really did a lot of good stuff for people. He was willing to stand up for the weak and helpless when everyone else was wimping out. So I kind of don't like to blame Leo, but it was really, he is the first true pope. He is the first one who asked for and received complete allegiance to the Bishop of Rome in all spiritual matters. Now, if you go a couple hundred years later, not quite a couple hundred years later, to about AD 600, there was another pope, Gregory, who kind of completed that process. For the next couple hundred years after Leo, the church had undisputed spiritual authority. Gregory, whom we'll talk about if you're in the fall class, he kind of took the next step, making the church the big secular authority. And that's where the church transformed into what it was in the Middle Ages. You know, the church at the beginning of the Middle Ages, what's happened is, in the West, Rome has fallen. The empire's gone. It's chaos. And the only recognizable remnant of the ancient world is the church. And so the Western Church, which they now began to call themselves the Roman Catholic Church, the Catholic Church, actually Gregory kind of put the Roman on there. They began to call themselves the Catholic Church. This was, everybody gave their loyalty to it. That was the only thing left of their familiar world. And so they kind of inherited all the old loyalty and sense of security, and this is why the Catholic Church became so powerful, because for so many people, it was the only desperate source of hope and stability and security. And so Leo and his successors inherited this incredible sense of loyalty. People desperately wanted that. Everything else was going crazy. The world took a huge step back. Your learning stopped. Science took a huge step back. You were in danger of your life every day from these barbarians. This was people's rock. This was what people looked to. Now, unfortunately, they weren't really looking to God. They were looking to the church. That's their mistake. But if you put yourself in their place, they had a lot more excuse to do it than we do. They had a lot more excuse to put their faith in something superficial than we do, and we do it all the time. So have some sympathy for them. In the East, the empire was still intact. A huge part of the empire still continued in the East with its capital at Constantinople. So in the East, the church leaders still had powerful political leaders to negotiate with. The church in the East was very powerful, but not all powerful. They took the name the Orthodox Church. And there still are many Orthodox churches around today. It's a very interesting choice of words. They called themselves the Catholic Church because it means what?
Universal.
They said, hey, we are the true church. Therefore, everything we do must be right. Orthodox means what?
Correct.
Means correct. They said, we're the ones who are doing it right. Therefore, we're the only true church. And all through the Middle Ages, they kept saying that to each other. They had arguments and fights and sometimes wars with each other because the Catholics said, hey, we're the true church. We got to be doing it right. And the Orthodox said, no, we're doing it right. Therefore, we're the true church. Now, we can make fun of them because that's another thing we never do, isn't it? Well, that's exactly what we do, isn't it? I'll let you figure out which place we are at the moment. That's more of a philosophical question, but we kind of swing back and forth between those at one time or another. Well, as we come back full circle to Romans 11, that doesn't mean that nobody was faithful. It just means the church, viewed as an institution, had become something completely opposite of what it was supposed to be. But the church as an institution is not the same as the people in that institution. Because to God, the church is always the individual believers who make up the body of Christ, not the other way around. It doesn't depend on what church you're a part of. When you say the Catholic Church, and when we go through the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church is responsible in the Middle Ages for some horrible things. That doesn't reflect at all on an individual Catholic either then or now. It reflects on the people who ran the church. It reflects on perhaps giving them too much power and too much security. But it doesn't mean that just because you're a Catholic, you're responsible for the horrors that the medieval Catholic Church perpetrated any more than the fact that we're Americans means we're responsible for the horrible things our country has done in the past. It just means that you need to realize that you better be honest about it and realize that we're all saved by grace. Again, that's why we need grace. Well, there was always a remnant, and there was never a time when there weren't a lot of people who realized this is not what the church is supposed to be. And just because they didn't carry a sign that said Church of Christ doesn't mean that they were not faithful believers who had a real relationship with God and were doing what little they could. And throughout the Middle Ages, there are lots of groups that were holdout churches, isolated churches, churches kind of left behind in all this chaos and distant parts of the empire where the Bishop of Rome could have no practical authority. There are lots of places where churches had simply, even in the midst of territories dominated by the Catholics or the Orthodox churches, still tried to maintain their own way of doing things. And there were many, many individual believers who were in these Orthodox and Catholic churches who still realized that it's not about the church, it's about God. And even though a lot of this has been lost to history, there are still some whose stories remain, whose writings remain. And that's going to be our next topic if you come back for the fall class. Because before we study the history of what we call the Church of Christ and talk about the things that have been done by our forerunners, so to speak, in our fellowship, it's important to realize that they didn't just wake up in the 1800s and realize that there was room for something new. There's always been people trying to do the same thing. Their efforts took many different forms. Maybe they believe things we don't believe. But you know, that's not important because the remnant is chosen by grace. The remnant is saved by grace. And so that's what we're going to try to do this fall, is we're going to try to take as gracious a look as we can as some more centuries of chaotic history unfold before us. Thank you very much for your extreme patience. And again, the next couple weeks, Frank and Jim have some special topics, and then I'll resume September 9th with the fall series. Thanks very much. Oh, the trivia. Oh, my goodness, the trivia question. Oh, my goodness, how could I forget this? What do Rembrandt, Abraham Lincoln, Walt Disney, and Archie Griffin all have in common? I put in Archie just for you Buckeye fans. Were they all born on February 12th? Did they all declare bankruptcy? Are they all known by their middle names? Was each the first in his family to go to college? Did each of them have or had a pet alligator or crocodile? Well, there actually was a president who had a pet alligator. John Quincy Adams had a pet alligator. Abraham Lincoln didn't go to college, so I think you know this is not the answer. They all declared bankruptcy. They all declared bankruptcy at some point, and there's actually an enormous number of famous people who at some time have declared bankruptcy. Henry Ford, Ulysses Grant, Mark Twain. Bankruptcy is a fact of life because material things come and go a lot of times without you having any control over it. Abraham Lincoln had declared bankruptcy through no fault of his own. He had a business partner who had cooked the books and embezzled a lot of money, and under the laws of the time, Abraham Lincoln was responsible for that. He lost everything he had, and he had to pay back all his partner's debts, and it took him 17 years. The laws then were even harsher than they are now. No fault of his own. Took a large part of his life just paying off debts for some crook that he had nothing, no real fault in it at all. A lot of famous people have done that. Now, you can also read that a lot of famous people have lost everything and never recovered. And the spiritual connection is that when you look at the history of the church, you know, we always tend to look at things in terms of, where's the church going? Oh, if the church collapses, I don't know what I'll do. Well, the spiritual application is, if you don't have any money, your life's not over. You're just going to have to go through some inconvenience for a while. If you do think it collapses, if it's not going where you think it's not going to go, it doesn't mean you don't still have God. It doesn't mean you don't still have God to keep track of you. When we look at the years when, in our eyes, the church probably just disintegrated and collapsed, it doesn't mean God wasn't there anymore. And just as some very great people came back from bankruptcy to do some great things, to do some wonderful things, the church has never stopped. There's always been a remnant because faith and grace are more important than external appearance or numbers or anything like that. And if your faith is really in God, you can keep going. Just like Walt Disney, Henry Ford, they had a dream from when they were very young of what they wanted to do. And they both blew it two or three times and had to start completely over. But eventually they got what they needed to do. Abraham Lincoln, all he ever wanted to do is be a good person and try to make the world a little bit better place. He spent years of his life toiling fruitlessly because of someone else's mistakes. But eventually what happened? He was able to be a great service to the world. And that's the spiritual perspective. We don't need to get caught up in all the problems with the church, whether it's our own or criticizing someone else's. It's being faithful and knowing that the remnant is chosen purely by grace and we're saved purely by grace. That's what keeps us going. And that's the perspective we want to take on history. So, two endings to the class today, and even more extreme patience on your part. Thank you so very much. Bye-bye.